Okay, now, proceeding with the story of the drug tug, again, a series that you broke, Harry, in the Napa Sentinel, and by the way, for the benefit of people that have just joined us, my name is Dave Emery, and we're interviewing Harry Martin, the editor of both the Napa Sentinel and the North American Investigative Journal, and we're talking about a case that Harry broke in the late 1980s and early 1990s, which in many ways presaged the widely distributed and very well-publicized San Jose Mercury News series, Dark Alliance, about connections between the intelligence community, the Contra War, and the drug trade. We've been tracing a Byzantine series of connections involving the bust of a barge load of drugs in San Francisco Bay in May of 1988, tracing that through a passport scam, General Noriega, figures involved in the Christic Institute's investigation in the late 1980s, and all of this connected with the intelligence community and the drug trade. Now, Harry, one of the things that you mention at considerable length, one of the things that figures very prominently in the tangled web surrounding the drug tug case, and that concerns a number of Napa companies and Napa properties which figure in the financial machinations, one of them being the LendVest case, or the LendVest company, excuse me.
Okay, LendVest was a mortgage company, and they were running the pyramid scheme to begin with, and they generally got seniors to mortgage their homes. Many, many, many seniors lost their homes and everything they owned with the drug tug thing. And what happened was the drug tug, the drug monies were being funneled in to the LendVest company, but only about $10,000 or $20,000 as far as the government could find. And yet the federal government came in and seized the entire company and took all its assets and everything else, and wiped everybody else out on the premise of that. And then they brought in a bankruptcy trustee, which was Charles Duck, and Charles Duck ended up being sent to prison with several other bankruptcy trustees for embezzlements of millions of dollars, of which most of them got the jobs back after they got out of prison. I mean, you see, it just spins off and spins off and spins off.
By the way, Harry, if you could speak as loudly as possible, because we've got some fair amount of interference here on the line.
Okay.
So just in terms of coming across on the broadcast signal, I've got you potted up all the way on my board here. Another of the companies that figures into the machinations surrounding the drug tug case was the Joseph Matthews Winery. Could you tell us a little more about that?
Well, that was a winery that was basically went bankrupt after this thing went down too, and various people there were put on trial. The people who are running the winery also are very close to the LendVest, and they were all close to the Robinson family, and many investors lost some money on that. That has now been bought in a bankruptcy sale, and it's now a conservatory for dance and music owned by some very legitimate people. And right next door, they were also running a house of prostitution at the time.
One of the things,
but very high level, not just a cheap brothel. This was for very high level visitors to the community.
One of the things that is often used in some of these types of operations, and this is an entirely speculative element, Harry. Do you know if perhaps that house of ill repute might have figured into political pressure / blackmail?
Oh yeah, I had the. Well, see. When these guys went down, we were able to get into the place, and we've got the appointment books, and we show who was sleeping with who, and we got the whole thing, and it's very high politics. And a lot of them would service Silverado Country Club, which is where all the high-level people go when they come to this general area.
Some of the names connected with this, as I recall, there were some very interesting dispositions of some of the cases of some of these people as the legal machinations unfolded. Robert Pittner
was the general manager of the Matthews winery, and then also the operator of the house next door, an old Victorian Hennessy house, and he went on trial. Most of these people are in Corning now, and they're beginning to come back, and they're trying to buy out shares in the local banks.
Now, Corning is that a small town?
And Corning's a town. Yeah, it's a little bit north of the Delta.
Okay. Okay. Because I'm not familiar with that particular town. A couple of other people, David Hansen.
David Hansen is still in prison. He was tried, he and Bittner were tried and found guilty in federal court for money laundering. However, that verdict was overturned, and Hansen was sentenced on state charges of running the pyramid scheme. And he's due to be paroled at any time.
There was also a couple called Lemons, as I recall, L-E-M-M-O-N-S.
The Lemons were acquitted, but what was rather strange was that Dick Lemons, who was one of the original owners of the mortgage company that became LendVest, the investigator for the FBI was a person he grew up with all his life, and they were like brothers. And so some of that material didn't go down well. But now the Lemons are trying they're back in Napa, and they're trying to buy bank stocks. So that what they want to do is take control of several of the local banks again.
Now, as I recall, Robert Pittner just got a wrist slap in connection with this.
Absolutely.
Any idea why he was handled so gently?
Well, we did show some of Pittner's connections to more organized crime.
So, from what I understand, the investigation into this case was attenuated and did not go on as nearly as long as it did, or it did not go as far as it might have.
Well, the district attorney sat on it. He absolutely refused to do anything about it, and the investors were... I went to the district attorney 2 years before this broke. I provided him with sufficient information. He refused to do anything about it, and I had some wars with the district attorney after that, and actually Pittner and Hansen went to the district attorney, and they wanted him to arrest me because they didn't like what I was doing, and the DA said if I could arrest him, I would have done it a long time ago. Well, we brought all that exposure up to the DA when he ran for election, and he used to win 70-80% of the vote, and when we got through with him, he only won 30% of the vote and lost.
So apparently at least one individual did have some repercussions from the case.
Yeah, so he refused to prosecute. So finally, by the time he prosecuted, you know, everything had been diluted, witnesses were gone, and so consequently, other than Hansen, the case went nowhere.
This is also an entirely speculative element, Harry, and non-determinative...
But Robinson's sister, who we have constant contact with, has been in the witness protection program since this happened because she was the major investor in Dredgemaster.
Yeah, no, what I meant was that the question I was about to ask you was a speculative element. You are currently a member of the Napa City Council, and you are now vice mayor of Napa?
Right.
And you also are currently awaiting the finalization of a vote count to make you a Napa County supervisor. One of the things that has characterized your political career, Harry, and also to a certain extent your publishing career, has been some very broad-based and enthusiastic support on the part of the population. Literally, you've been a populist in the best sense of the word, and yet I hate the term because that has kind of a 60s connotation, but the Napa establishment has been anything but friendly towards Harry Martin. Do you think that has anything to do with some of your muckraking on the drug tug case?
No, it just has to do with muckraking on everything. All the wineries and all the establishment came out with my opponent in this race and spent $30,000-$40,000 in his campaign, where I got about $30,000, but from the smaller people. And the thing is, they hit me with everything they could, from integrity, credibility. The DA, right in the middle of the race, one of the donors filed a perjury charge on me, and I had to go through all that publicity on it, and finally the Attorney General's office threw it totally out. There was no merit to it. They would run stories going back to 30 and 40 years ago on speculation that I didn't pay child support, and things like this, and it just, they hit me with everything they could.
But in the end, it wouldn't hunt.
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, it may have worked, but the thing is that they still refer to me as a populist with the community, and they do not like it.
Back to the drug tug case per se. Now, among the many interesting connections in this case, concerns, and you touched on this earlier, concerns Calvin Robinson, the drug tug skipper, currently languishing in jail, and a fellow named Christopher Boyce. Could you tell us a little bit more about Christopher Boyce and then the of Falcon and the Snowman fame?
Yeah, well, that the movie was The Falcon and the Snowman, and they referred to him as Choir Boy, and he was working not as a CIA agent per se as far as out in the field, but he worked with the technology and the satellite thing, and the CIA has several satellites up there, and he sold the technology of that to the Soviets, and he was sentenced to life in prison, of which he escaped from prison with Calvin Robinson's assistance, and he fled all the way up to either Oregon, Idaho, Montana, I can't remember exactly the location, and Robinson hit him out, and finally he was captured and brought back to prison, and then they were unsuccessful in trying Robinson for aiding and abetting the escape of a criminal. But now, and Robinson has been moved across the country on a constant basis. They will not keep him in the same federal prison. He writes a lot of letters. We get letters from all the time, and he brings out, he has challenged certain elements of this thing, and they just keep moving him around.
So in other words, Calvin Robinson has not gone quietly.
No, he has not, and he will not. He knows that he's there for the duration, and of course, I don't know what letters we don't get. But we do get letters, and of course, you know, he was not exactly thrilled with me in the beginning because we were not exactly complimentary to his position. But at the same time, he felt there was enough integrity there to at least correspond.
And at this point, obviously, he faces two life terms.
That's correct. And what's so funny is I've got both sides of his family coming to me, and they're at actual war with each other, and neither side knows the other side is communicating.
Could you tell us that, you know, I don't want you to disclose any professional confidences that you couldn't, but can you tell us a little bit about that division?
Well, yeah, I know he's trying to get one side to help him with his case and say these things are wrong. The other side is supplying me with documentation which has shown this whole history to be correct as what we printed, but also it gets in even deeper. And we are restricted by our agreement not to publish any of this material until the Coast Guard is finished with the thing. The Coast Guard is going on their own investigation at the present time.
So the Coast Guard is currently, this case is still under investigation?
It's still under investigation because it deals with a much broader scheme than a lot of people realize.
One of the things that you mentioned as I was during the break when we were turning over our cassette, and that is that as the investigation has proceeded, there have continued to be some untimely demises in connection with the case.
Yeah, a lot of the crew members and who are relatives of nephews and so forth of Calvin Robinson, while a grand jury in Sacramento was looking into the drug tug case and some of this material, these witnesses were shot to death in front of their houses, and not at the same time, at different times, but people come right up to the house and blow them out with 12-gauge shotguns, and none of anybody that has been involved in the shootings have never been apprehended.
So it would appear that the higher echelons in this case are not only still protected, but may very well proceed well into the corridors of power.
Yeah, well, you have to understand, Calvin is not the smartest man in the world. He's not that well educated. He's so he's a pawn. But somebody else had to have higher abilities to finance this material and make sure it goes to the right places and so forth. And as they say, we were supplied with the materials as to the contact that was originally made to Calvin, which is part of the transcript of the trial, and it shows that that person, the contact, was a phony company in Seattle, which we believed, based upon the person who he was talking to, and we traced that person, he is a CIA operative. And so consequently, they set him up, and I think what happened, they didn't set him up to be caught, they just got him to do the job. And this is not the first time he did this. This is the third trip. But somebody in the Coast Guard was tipped off, and actually the tip-off came from the sheriff's department, and it came from his ex-wife.
Interesting.
That's how it all came down, because that material, he was not supposed to be seized. They were supposed to land in the south portion of Napa on a very deserted area. And in fact, Hansen went down to buy the big house on the point, the only house there, and he offered them way above the proper price for it because they had to, that's where the drug tug was going to land.
The financing of some of these operations, you mentioned at one point in your article that the amount of money, I believe it was, that was missing from LendVest was the same as the amount of money that was involved with one of the one element of the drug tug operation. I've forgotten offhand exactly how that correlated.
Well, it's hard. It's been a while, but it was basically the money's missing there, and then Robin, then LendVest, the people who went down to buy the house off the point and everything else, so they all had that involvement. And it was also a pyramid scheme, as they say. So the bottom person invests so that the top people could be paid, and then, you know, you just have to keep more, getting more and more investors. So between running an illegal drug operation, they were also running an illegal Ponzi scheme.
The people who invested in LendVest, did they ever get their money back?
Absolutely not. The government seized all the money, and these people, I know of people who lost their entire life savings. The older ones ended up with dog food, living on dog food. Some people had heart attacks. They're in mobile home units now or little apartments. Their whole life savings went out, and some actually had to go back. In fact, I was talking to this woman about a year ago, and her husband had to go back to work almost as a janitor at the age of 70, and it killed him. And the mayor, who was just recently killed in an accident, anytime you bring up LendVest, he was furious because he lost a lot. And all those investors, incidentally, came, a lot of them, from this one church. And that one church is where the candidate is that I'm running against right now.
Hmm. And that's, it's unfortunate whether that happened to
the pastor was involved.
The pastor of the church was, now, was he involved when you say, did he lose money?
No, the pastor was, we did a check on real estate things. The pastor has joint ownership of 12, 15 properties that Robert Hansen's involved with. And he encouraged all his parishioners to participate. He's no longer there at the church.
So basically, he was caring for his flock in more senses than one.
Absolutely. Flocking the flock.
Fleecing the flock, maybe.
Yes, yes.
Well, it has been known to happen. With regard to some of your other investigative series, Harry, you've also pursued a number of other investigations of various national security-related information. And one case in particular in which you were the first person to cover the case in a substantive fashion, and then it later became something of a political football in terms of the ongoing intelligence scandals surrounding the Bush administration, and that was the Inslaw case. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, Inslaw was a former member of the CIA, formed his own company to create software. The Justice Department was looking for a system that would track all their cases so that no matter where you were in the country, you could track a case. And so, consequently, he developed that software, and he sent it over to the Justice Department for purchasing. That was the Justice Department of Mr. Meese. And involved in that, and that's good. I've got an update on you for this one. Involved with Dr. Earl Bryan, who was the Secretary of Health under Reagan when he was governor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one that wanted to bring the black kids to the Nike missile sites that were abandoned and use them for mind control experimentation. And he got involved, and Meese ended up canceling this guy's contract. And first of all, they tried to buy this guy's rights to the software, and he said no. And then the Meese people refused to pay him. The company went bankrupt, and the government tried to force an issue. The bankruptcy judge says, hey, you know, the government has played a dirty trick on this guy, and in fact, they owe him all this money. The judge is removed. Bankruptcy judge has served for 14 years. He was removed, not reappointed right after that. Bryan, who also owned WebTech, which was a big scandal in the government and so forth, and of which Meese's wife had investments in, and he ends up owning the Inslaw software. Well, then the Inslaw software was modified on the Cabazon Indian reservation in near Riverside, and it was modified so that it could track people, not just cases, but people, and then they sold it to foreign countries with a system in there by which they could hack into the system and find out all their intelligence information. So anyway, a lawsuit was filed. Congress held an investigation and said this was a real scam on the part of the government. And but the key whistleblower, Ricardo Shuto, ended up in prison for and was warned. We wrote the story about Ricardo Shuto was going to be sent to prison if he testified against the government, and sure enough, he was arrested and after our article and sent to prison on a charge of manufacturing methamphetamine. And
this, by the way, is a longtime CIA asset named Mike Reconosciuto.
Yeah, he was the whiz kid for computers and things like this. He was the one who modified that software for the government.
There was a recent article in Unclassified put out by the Association of National Security Alumni, which further developed the trap door, the back door in the Promise software. Apparently, what that did was that took the information in the files of whatever computer bank was being used. It was being used in and beamed them right up to satellites.
And then we broke the story that Barry Kumnick had made a quantum leap in that software, whereby not only will it track people, but it with the artificial intelligence and predicated upon the people's past patterns, it could project where they were, what they would do if they couldn't find them.
This was the Brainstorm software, correct?
Right, and of course, we broke that, and then Kumnick disappeared, and we were very concerned with his welfare because all this was gone. And he finally surfaced about a year and a half later, coming out of hiding. He had worked for TRW at the time. But what I want to tell you about Dr. Bryan, by the way, is our information we received now is that he's just been found guilty of 24 felony counts. I haven't got all the details yet, but apparently a California court has just found him guilty, and I'm trying to get the records on that right now.
Was this in connection? I know he was involved with some machinations vis-a-vis the UPI.
Well, he owned UPI, but it went bankrupt under his jurisdiction. But you see, here's a problem. And also, now remember, Bryan was the man, and this has been admitted to, this is not speculation, Bryan was the man who set up a meeting in Washington, D.C. and a meeting in Spain in order for the Reagan campaign, this is before Reagan's president, to negotiate the hostage release or non-release. And Bryan was in the forefront of those negotiations. This is record. This is not speculation.
We're going to get to the whole issue of the complicity of the Reagan-Bush campaign with the Iranians in a couple of minutes. With regard to the Inslaw case, Harry, and the situation of Michael Reconosciuto, we should note that he was threatened with prosecution. Later, that prosecution did indeed take place. And the woman who warned Mike Reconosciuto about what was going to happen to him, Bally Delahan, he met with an unhappy end.
That's right, and also his wife, they threatened that they would take the children away from his wife, her children, because her husband worked for Wackenhut. And consequently, that also took place, and the woman was in my office showing me all of Reconosciuto's documents, because she didn't know what they were, and of course it gave me the validity of Reconosciuto, because I had worked in technology areas of defense, and there were things in there that, you know, I recognize from the days when I used to have to write about them. As soon as she left my office, she was arrested and extradited to the state of Washington.
With regard to the Inslaw case, we were co-defendants in a nuisance lawsuit involving a tiny Indian tribe in Southern California.
I just ran across that thing today. I was cleaning out some legal files, and I ran across that lawsuit. And it didn't last long. It was the shortest libel suit I've ever had in history. It lasted about 60 days, of which I threatened the whole issue of the Cabazon. It was some women who belonged to Cabazon tribe sued us for libel, indicating that because we talked about weapons manufacturing and this Inslaw manufacturing on the Cabazon Indian tribe, that it injured them. And basically, when I turned around and threatened them with action, they dropped the suit, if you remember, and then they dropped it on all of us at that time.
We should perhaps fill the audience in with how this tiny tribe of Indians, the Cabazons, originally only 30 people, how they figured into this intelligence and national security connected situation.
Well, it isn't the Indian. Indian people themselves, and this is what we point out in the lawsuit, is the fact is that Indian tribes have a certain autonomy. And consequently, to do some of the things from the gold smuggling and gun running and so forth, sometimes you can't legally do it within the United States, but you can do some of this stuff on Indian tribes which have their own autonomy. And for instance, there is one tribe that part of their lands go into Mexico and the other part goes in the United States, and that's used as a corridor all the time. And of course, we're getting into the Nichols people, and of course, that's another story by itself.
One of the things we should point out about the Cabazons is that there were only 30 people in this tribe, that they were not subject to U.S. customs laws, and this made their reservation an ideal vehicle for the use of the intelligence community with regard to a number of activities. Five of them were murdered in connection with this.
Yeah, five were murdered when they started to blow the whistle. Well, actually, only one Indian. The others were friends of them, but there was only actually one Indian that was killed. And he was speaking out at the tribal council dealing with the subject. And, of course, they also brought in casinos. That was one of the first places they brought casinos in, if you remember. And it was just a total abuse, but they made tons of money having these people in there. And Wackenhut was involved heavily in those that operation. Now, remember now, we're talking about Reconosciuto altering the software with Wackenhut involved in the situation, and then we end up with his wife losing her children to the husband, her ex-husband, who is a Wackenhut employee. I mean, you can just see the rounds and rounds. It just really gets involved.
We should note, too, that the a point of information that the Cabazon tribe themselves, as you made quite clear in your series and in our discussions on air, they were victims of this operation. They were not perpetrators, and hence the lawsuit was totally frivolous because we were not libeling or, in my case, slandering the Cabazons. On the contrary, we were standing up for them and pointing out that they were victims of this operation.
Well, one of the reasons we got the case dismissed early, too, was the fact that they did not... if anybody was to sue us, it should have been the Cabazon tribe. And at the same time, they were trying us in state court when, in fact, they had to go to federal court because of the jurisdiction. And, of course, other than that, it was all public record, there were three of us that were sued.
Six different defendants,
yeah,
I believe.
I mean, three main parties, Virginia, you and I, and, of course, the station was involved. And, mm-hmm. We were the three because Virginia had been working on it, and I had been working on it, and you had been, interviewing both of us at the time. In fact, there were statements made on the air by Virginia that brought the slander on her, and mine was based on the articles, but they were read on your on the air. So basically, the focal point was the radio rather than the printed word.
Yeah, actually, the only people named in all five counts were myself, the now-defunct tape duplication service that used to carry my archive tapes, and the two radio stations, one in Southern California and KFJC, that
in Virginia.
Yeah, and but she was only I think named in one of the counts or two, was then dropped. Harry, we're almost out of time for this half hour segment. Could you give interested listeners the details concerning your website and where they can get some of the press packets concerning some of your various national security related investigations?
Well, you can get the information on freeamerica.com. You don't need www. Just freeamerica.com, all lowercase. That'll bring you to the website, which will bring you on to all these articles and all the interrelated articles from the drug tug to the Innslaw case to the Federal Reserve Bank, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's freeamerica, all one word, .com. And if you don't have a computer, then you can write to us at 925 Lincoln Avenue. That's 925 Lincoln Avenue, Napa, California, 945-58, 945-58. Or you can fax us at 707-257-3035. That's 707-257-3035. And we do have a print list that if anybody needs it, we can fax it back or write it back to them, showing them the different articles. Or if you go on the website, you will have a list of the materials. It'll be broken down by national, international, government control, religion and history, whatever subject you're interested in.
All righty. We have been interviewing Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel and the North American Investigative Journal. For Harry Martin, my name is Dave Emery, saying thanks for listening.